From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The Safety Act's controversial elimination of cash bail took center stage before justices in Springfield.
Take the question, put it on a ballot, propose it to the people, let them vote on it, and an election.
A Kankakee County judge ruled the act unconstitutional after 68 prosecutors across the state filed lawsuits saying getting rid of the cash bail system puts criminals back on the street.
The abuse and neglect that took place at Choate is awful. Obviously, we're very focused on making sure that that facility is doing what it needs to do to care for the people who live there. We're going to continue to upgrade and provide the services that people need and the personnel that are appropriate for that facility.
That's Governor J.B. Pritzker. He recently announced changes for the state-run Choate Mental Health and Developmental Center in southern Illinois. That's after news reports surfaced about abuse of patients there. We will talk with the reporter who's been on that story. And we also heard in the open there the Kankakee County State's Attorney Jim Rowe. He was arguing before the Illinois Supreme Court this week against the state's new law that would eliminate cash bail. We'll have more on that case ahead on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and joining us today we have Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And joining us later in the program, we'll hear from Beth Hunsdorfer, an investigative reporter with Capital News Illinois. But first, we're checking in with Mawa Iqbal, a reporter for WBEZ and Illinois Public Radio Stations. And Mawa, it's good to have you on with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You were at the Supreme Court this week. Those cash bail arguments were heard there. People may remember this law because it was quite controversial, came up during the elections a lot. State's attorneys, law enforcement, many of them are opposed to it. They say it will compromise public safety. What was the arguments made on both sides on this earlier this week before the court?
Yeah, so I guess it would probably be easiest to break it down to two main arguments. And so the first one was, you know, is this law constitutional, right? So is getting rid of cash bail constitutional? It was like the first, I guess, point of contention. And then the second one would be a question of separation of powers. So does the legislature have this power to, you know, change the constitution, the state constitution, and get rid of cash bail? So the plaintiffs, of course, argued that this law does violate the state constitution. They pointed out that there is a line in the constitution that says a person shall be, quote, bailable by sufficient sureties. And so they take that to mean a monetary bail. Whereas the defendants argued that this can not necessarily mean monetary bail, but can apply to any sort of pretrial condition that is placed on a person that brings them back to court. So an example of this would be electronic monitoring. And then, you know, of course, the second argument being the separation of powers, plaintiffs argued that, you know, if you're going to change the Constitution or ratify it anyway, it has to be done through the voters in a referendum or a ballot measure that people vote on during an election, rather than lawmakers, you know, coming in and just changing it. Whereas the defendants argued that, you know, that this doesn't change the Constitution, so we don't have to bring to the voters in the first place, you know, that this is something that legislatures have been doing for the past six decades, you know, passing policies that affect pretrial procedures and affect the criminal justice system. So that's kind of, they were arguing that if the panel rules in the plaintiff's favor, this would sort of reverse, you know, six decades of precedent of, you know, lawmakers passing policies to affect pretrial conditions.
Yeah. Charlie, what did you hear in the arguments this week? Anything that stood out to you?
One of the things that struck me was that even before the court would get to the issues that Mawa talked about in terms of the whether or not the line in the Constitution that talks about bail requires that it be monetary, because the Constitution doesn't specifically say that, and whether or not there was an infringement on the separation of powers, that the legislature was getting involved in business that belonged to the court. I thought one of the interesting points, and something on which the case may indeed turn, was the fact that there was some questioning of the state's attorneys. Why are you guys here? Do you even have a right to be here? What is your standing? Mm-hmm. I think that, if I'm not mistaken, from the stories that I read, right at the very beginning, Supreme Court Chief Justice Mary Jane Tice interrupted the Kankakee County State's Attorney, James Rowe, who was representing the plaintiffs. And she said, how does this statute adversely impact the rights of elected state's attorneys? And Rowe said, well, we've taken an oath of office to uphold and defend the Constitution. And then Tice says, well, isn't that the oath that we all took? And so are you saying that every lawyer in the state of Illinois has the standing to challenge the statute? So that struck me that that would be a way for the court, without having to get into the further into the weeds about the substance of the argument, just to say in the first place, hey, you guys don't even belong here. You have no standing to be in court. Yeah. And were they to rule that way, presumably they would send the case back down to Kankakee County and tell the judge in Kankakee County, just dismiss it. So the question about whether or not cash bail remains would sort of be up in the air, but I assume what the court would do is they would dismiss the case, and therefore the law would go into effect as is until someone who is basically affected by the law can come in and argue that this is infringing upon my rights. And I'm trying to envision who that might be. Let's say I get arrested and I don't have to pay cash bail. Am I going to go in and argue, well, this no bail law is unconstitutional. I should be allowed to or required to post a cash bail and then I can walk free. I'm having a hard time envisioning a scenario where somebody would do that.
Yeah, well, you heard this. You heard those questions being raised by the justices as well. That stood out to me when I listened back to that. That maybe this could be the key part of a decision by the court. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm just agreeing with everyone. You know, I feel like that's what stuck out to me as well. Just hearing Justice Tice sort of interrupting Mr. Rowe before, or I guess like a couple seconds after he started his opening arguments. And it was interesting because his defense, or I guess his response to her line of questioning was sort of, you know, we as sheriffs and state attorneys have this inherent duty to uphold public safety. And we want to, you know, make sure the community is safe from criminals. And so that's why we have a standing in this. That was sort of the point he was making, was, you know, this is why we are interested, is because we have a special interest to uphold public safety. But it kind of honestly reminded me of some of the rhetoric that we heard during the midterm cycle last fall, right? Where you had a lot of conservative, more Republican candidates campaigning on this whole idea that if this law were to go into effect January 1st, you know, it'll just be like a whole free for all where like it's just criminals let on the streets on the loose, you know, and oftentimes I heard people, candidates likening it to this horror movie called The Purge, where the plot of that movie is essentially, you know, like crime is allowed for like a 12-hour period and it's just like full on mayhem. Obviously that rhetoric has been debunked, you know, that this law would definitely not create that scenario. But it did sort of remind me of that, you know, that this sort of rhetoric that like somehow, you know, like communities will be less safe if this cash bill elimination were to go into effect.
You mentioned the election last year, and following the campaign cycle in which we heard so much about this, there was some legislation, sort of follow-up legislation that occurred in the fall. What would that do? As looking back at that, for those that don't remember, it seemed like it tried to tighten things up a bit.
Yeah, so basically it did a couple things. So it's like the bigger things was it would say that prosecutors have to provide specific evidence about why a person is dangerous and should be detained. So as it is now, you know, obviously judges will still have discretion under the law to detain someone if they pose a danger to the community or a flight risk. And so with the new changes that were added in the fall, it would kind of place that burden on prosecutors to now provide specific evidence on why this person is dangerous. And then judges can also issue arrest warrants for people who don't show up to court. It also added some more provisions on stalking too. So if a person is charged with stalking or stalking related crimes, that can also be cause for a judge to detain somebody. So it just kind of gave judges a little more power to detain people.
What are the issues that I didn't see reported on, whether or not it came up or not, and I don't know if it did at the hearing, the fact that doing away with cash bail is going to cost counties a lot of money, because they make a ton of money off cash bail and off fees and everything attendant to it. Was that raised at all? Because in my own mind, that to me is probably one of the major reasons why these, and I think all of the state's attorneys, but one or two were from downstate, some of them from very small counties, where they are arguing, well, we need to keep cash bail for all these criminal justice reasons, when in reality, it's the money that's involved.
Yeah, so I didn't hear that in the oral arguments, but after everything wrapped up, we saw the Will County state's attorney, James Glasgow, and we talked to him just about his reactions, and he's named as one of the plaintiffs in the suit too. And so he mentioned that too. He was like, you know, there isn't enough in the law that would provide financial support for public defenders' offices. And so he kind of touched on that, but otherwise I didn't hear much about the financial burden that some offices may face.
And it looks like it's going to be a few months before we get a decision on this. So Mawa, we will have you back on at that time to help sort through what the justices have to say. We appreciate you being on with us today here on State Week.
Thank you.
That's Mawa Iqbal. She's a reporter for WBEZ and also for Illinois Public Radio stations. And now joining us, Beth Hunsdorfer of Capital News Illinois. She and Molly Parker of Lee Enterprises have been working on a series of stories with ProPublica about concerns at the Shote Mental Health and Developmental Center located in the southern Illinois town of Anna. And Beth, thanks for coming on the show with us.
Thanks for asking me. I appreciate it.
Let's lay out for those that aren't quite aware of this what your reporting uncovered about what was happening at the facility.
We uncovered by looking at substantiated Office of the Inspector General, they're the DHS watchdogs, a series of reports about abuse and neglect and the efforts that were in place to obstruct investigations or impede investigations that looking into those things. We found some pretty horrific accounts of patients being abused by staff and being neglected by staff, and just a general lack of reporting, because everybody who works at that facility is mandated to report any accounts of abuse or neglect that they see.
And some of those cases of abuse were, you know, quite shocking. I believe, you know, broken bones in some cases. There were other things that you found?
We found, as we said in our first story, as we accounted a man who had been thrown to the, refused to pull up his pants at the breakfast table as they were sagging, and the staff ordered him to pull up his pants, and he was brought to the ground and beaten by a staff member and restrained for 2 hours without medical care, with the person who is alleged to have abused him just an arm's length away. So and threatening him that he better keep his mouth shut.
When we talk about people who are housed at a facility like Shote, what kind of mental capacity do a lot of these people have? I mean, does it run a wide gamut there? Is it people who can function up to a certain level? You know, explain that a little bit more.
Well, there are different varieties of populations that are there. You have people who are mentally ill. That accounts for about 49 psychiatric beds at the facility. People who are developmentally disabled. 20% of the entire population is nonverbal. So they are profoundly disabled people. And approximately 112 are there on a court order, meaning they've had a criminal charge that has led them to be placed at Shote to receive treatment, or they have dual diagnosis, or that 112 is kind of the forensic unit, the dual diagnosis unit those things that where people have a developmental disability, but they've also been diagnosed with a mental illness.
Charlie, there has been a lot of push through the years to get away from institutionalization. It's complicated, though, because a lot of families, they don't have the resources to take care of people. What you've heard here about this, I mean, it falls in line with stories we've heard in the past.
Yeah, and in my case, with stories that have been around for more than 50 years, as the state, in terms of helping people with developmental disabilities, people with mental illness, stopping housing them in huge warehouses and instead trying to put them into community settings. And I think, and Beth, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe there's a court case that requires folks to be placed in the least restrictive setting in which they can function.
Yes, that's the there is a federal court case that mandates that they be in the least restrictive setting. But I guess I don't want to put too fine a point on it. You know, a lot of these individuals have had care from their parents, or and they've had a catastrophic death, an illness, and they're no longer able to provide care. And this becomes the option. So
well,
it is.
And from your reporting, there are, I don't know what the percentage would be, but there are quite a few of the parents and family members who are very much opposed to any notion of having their loved ones removed from SHOT because that's their home. And one case that struck me, a woman whose son was actually beaten there still wants to keep him there.
I don't want to put too fine of a point on. I think there are I think the people who want to keep them there are vocal, and I think they are they want to have easy access to their loved ones, which is understandable. And I think in some cases they have had to sacrifice security for care and accessibility. So I mean, what a terrible choice.
Well, I was going to say there's all these different forces at play. For starters, as Beth, as you're saying, if I'm a parent and I have a child who's developmentally disabled and he's at SHOT and I'm satisfied that this is the best place for him or her because I cannot care for that child at home any longer. And I'm thinking, if my loved one suddenly gets uprooted and sent somewhere else, and it could be somewhere many miles away, and it'd be much more difficult for me to visit him, I'm not going to want that. Then on the other hand, you have the community itself, where I'm guessing in Anna, the jobs at SHOT are probably some of the better paying jobs in the area. And so there's that worry about what's going to happen to the employees if we downsize. And I think the governor has stressed that we're not going to lay anybody off, which is is an issue. And then there's the advocates for the developmentally disabled who are arguing, well, yeah, but for their own good, we have to put them in a least restrictive setting. And then the other side of the coin is, well, where are those facilities? Because my understanding from the stories that I've read is that the state really doesn't have enough of these kinds of placements, and it's hard to get new ones because we're not paying people enough to do that kind of very difficult work.
Yeah, Beth, fill us in on what the governor has had to say, or what is going to happen at SHOT.
The plan is, they're calling it a transition, where 123 people who are there, placed there voluntarily, but either by guardians or the state guardian, will be moved within the next 3 years. And a series of evaluations will happen about the other 110 people who are there in the forensics and specialty units to determine their future. In the meantime, they have, you know, hired a statewide security chief who will be overseeing security at all the facilities, and they're still moving ahead with plans to install cameras in those forensic units.
Yeah, when I hear the idea of the people moving, it makes me think that from the administration perspective, that a lot of the problem here may be that it's too overwhelmed, too many people. Is that what you took away from this?
I think that this culture has kind of, you know, as with any workplace, a culture has kind of grown up over a long period of time. And when you have that kind of culture of, well, the OIG called it the culture of cover up that is there, and he's documented how it occurs and how new employees are indoctrinated into it, it's really tough to kind of break through that. And I don't know if it is a matter of being overwhelmed or this is just so ingrained that it, I think the governor said it himself, that the changes that they had done to try to reform it, they realized pretty quickly that it wasn't enough. So they moved to plan B, which was this transition.
I would guess that there are employees, though, we don't want to paint everybody with a broad brush. There has been abuse of patients that's been documented. But at the same time, there are people who work there who I think, I'm sure, care deeply about these people that they care for. And, you know, what's been their reaction to this?
They want to protect the jobs at the facility. I think there are good people who work there, and I can't underscore that enough. There are good people that work there that are horrified by some of the things that have happened. And I don't want to take away from that. It is a very difficult job. And I think that we have tried to underscore that in our reporting too, that the job's tough. The state wages are good. There are efforts to improve them in the private sector, to improve wages in the private sector, but it's a difficult job.
How has the union reacted? AFSCME, I believe, represents many of the employees there, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they do. If you remember back to, I believe it was 2012, when there were efforts to try to close Murray, the union joined forces with the Parents Association to and local leaders to keep that facility open. And today it remains in force. And in fact, some of the people from Shote may go to Murray for care. And that's in Centralia. So it's not terribly far away, but it is, it is a trip.
I know the governor's been asked about the closure, the full-on closure of Anna. He has said, I believe, that that is not on the table right now, but he hasn't ruled that out down the road, correct?
I think that he has not ruled it out down the road, but he did talk about the psychiatric unit, that there's a need for psychiatric care placements in the state of Illinois. So you may see some shifting to move more in the direction of adding more psychiatric services and psychiatric beds down there.
Aren't the folks who are there, what would you say, for want of a better term, who are there because they committed some crime, aren't they the psychiatric ones, as opposed to the folks who are developmentally disabled?
There are 49 just strictly psychiatric beds at Shote. I don't know the balance of how, if they're there under court order, but again, you've seen DHS come under fire from county sheriffs saying they're not moving people who are mentally ill out of county jails fast enough too. Yeah. So this may fill that need.
That's part of a larger picture that the state has faced for years, and particularly after the budget stalemate a few years ago. We just have needs that are recognized and acknowledged. We don't have the resources, not just the financial resources, but the actual service stuff in place to handle these kinds of needs.
I think you see that across the social services, all the way across. You know, a lot of services were collapsed during the budget crisis. And now that things have sort of stabilized, it takes a minute to have those agencies that provide those services to kind of gain the confidence to restore what they had. So yeah. I think they're in the process of trying to do that. And you see that in, you know, DCFS, DHS, lots of social agencies now. So the budget crisis is still reverberating.
So this plan for the Schott's Mental Health Developmental Center, that is, how is that going to impact, or will it impact, similar facilities in the state?
Well, I think there's going to be similar scrutiny is going to be brought to facilities across the state as well. I mean, I hope what our reporting has done is brought to light the situations that are occurring in these facilities. And there has been, Illinois is one of few states that still has the system in place and continues to place people in these big state-operated developmental centers. So I think that there will be a push to kind of take a look at the whole Illinois' role in that, and whether or not they want to privatize and expand services for the developmentally disabled into the private sector.
And Beth, before I let you go, you are, along with Molly Parker, you're going to be continuing your coverage and really focusing in on how this plan is carried out and what happens in the future.
Yes, that's our plan. I think, as I said, this will be for the people who have developmental disabilities, who are leaving their homes and leaving their friends, or changing environments. It'll be a stressful time, so it'll be interesting to see how what support services are in place to help them transition, and what programming there is to help them meet their full capabilities.
All right. Well, a few seconds left here, Charlie. Let's go to you for a note from the field.
Okay. Well, Illinois got another credit upgrade this past week. Moody's Investor Service announced that our bond rating has gone up to A3 from Baa1, and that's the eighth credit upgrade the state has received in less than 2 years. And the Moody's caution that although our financial outlook is stable, it balances the state's financial progress with the uncertainty of the present economic climate. Moody said the state's lean financial reserves and heavy long-term liability and fixed cost burdens make it more vulnerable than other states in a negative shift in the national and global economy. And we also heard from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois that the state of Illinois finished FY22 in its strongest fiscal position in more than two decades. The Institute said the revenue increased by about $22 billion over FY21. Expenditures increased by less than $10 billion. So we're in a very strong fiscal position. But again, they sounded a warning. If we continue to expand spending without regard to revenue slowdown, our financial condition could rapidly worsen.
All right. Well, we'll continue to watch that as well. Thanks for being with us here on State Week. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Mawa Iqbal of WBEZ, and also Illinois Public Radio. And also we heard from Beth Hunsdorfer. She's with Capital News Illinois. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app or iTunes. Just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.